This message is from the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.
I read a few years ago of the British and the French who were skirmishing. It was in the early 1700s, I believe. Louis XIV was reigning as France's monarch. And an English captain whose ship lay off the coast of France, awaiting the call to war, didn't want to waste his time, and so he ordered that his men practice their target shooting, that is with their cannons, at a nearby castle that was, in typical French fashion, adorned around the top with plaster reliefs of patron saints. So these men began practicing and spent their hours in the harbor sharpening their aim. It was interesting what I read, because when they were called to war, it was called so suddenly that they were unable to refurbish the ship, and they had to set sail immediately, and they lost at sea, not because they were outmanned or outmaneuvered, they lost because they ran out of ammunition. They had spent far too much of it shooting at the saints. I believe one of the common problems with us facing the real enemy in the real battle is not that we are outmaneuvered or outmanned, it is because we spend far too much time and way too much ammunition shooting at the saints. This is not a new problem, that is, believer getting along with believer. You read it in the New Testament, the church in Corinth was struggling between one believer suing another believer in court. You read that the church in Philippi, it was rather interesting because there in that church were two women who were so at odds with one another that it had torn the church. Paul even gave their names as he compelled them to get along. One was named Euodia, someone renamed her Odious, and Syntyche, somebody renamed her Soontouchy. I don't know how accurate that is. But I think of the Galatian church as well that had developed this reputation for intense in-house fighting. And they were struggling in the real war because of it. Divisiveness over anything and everything is a contemporary problem today, and it is something that you and I battle with. Either we are part of the problem or we are the target. But as we study the books of the Bible and as issues are raised, perhaps God is warning us of what can happen, what may be happening that I am not aware of. We are about to observe our study, whose name is Gideon. Would you take your Bibles and turn to chapter 7? Face the most devastating problems he has yet to face. Now, earlier in my study of this book, since it was my first time around the block in the book of Judges, I felt like Gideon's greatest struggle would be against the Midianites. They were the real enemy. They would cause the most trouble. But as I later studied, and this past week went into the next few chapters, it became apparent to me that his most difficult moments in following the will of God came from what he had to face with his own people, his own Hebrew brothers and sisters, as they should have been encouraging him, instead discouraged him. The last part of Judges chapter 7 is really the mopping up expedition. Gideon's 300 had stood on the hillside and had waved some torches and shouted a little bit and blown their trumpets, and they routed the enemy, and 120,000 of them took each other's lives. Gideon never raised a sword. 15,000 Midianites, however, escaped. They were on camels, and so as he tries to catch them and finish the job, speed is of the essence. And so he radios ahead, one of his own men, and he asks the Ephraimites to do something for him. Look at chapter 7, verse 24. And Gideon sent messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against Midian and take the waters before them, that is, cut them off at the pass, as far as Beth Barah and the Jordan." So all the men of Ephraim were summoned, and they took the waters as far as Beth Barah and the Jordan. And they captured the two leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. Their names are a literal rending would be Raven and Wolf. And they killed the Raven at the Rock Raven, and they killed Wolf, the wine press named after him, while they pursued Midian. And they brought the heads of Raven and the Wolf to Gideon from across the Jordan. Kind of a gruesome thing that occurred, typical in that fashion in that day, proof that they had indeed conquered. Now, what I would expect, if I didn't read any further, would be the tribe of Ephraim bringing proof of their victory to Gideon. They haven't seen him now for a while. They've heard the story of Gideon's 300. And what I would expect is an awful lot of back slapping and hallelujahs and congratulations and isn't God wonderful. But what happens instead? Look at chapter 8, verse 1. The men of Ephraim, when they meet up with him, said to him, "What is this thing you have done to us, not calling us when you went to fight Midian?" And they contended with him vigorously. Fascinating. Let's back up and try to understand why. Because Ephraim had a problem that had developed over the years, and at this point in their history, they are the most prominent tribe. They claim men from their tribe like Joshua. We find them here, the most prominent tribe, who have within their borders, by the way, the two religious centers. The tabernacle is housed in Shiloh, in their territory, and Bethel is also within their domain. So they're used to people coming from all over the promised land to them. They've evidently grown proud about the fact that they're the tribe who is most prominent. The key words in understanding how they treated Gideon are the words contended, which has to do, it could be translated in terms of a sharp public conflict, and the word vigorously, which means violently. They literally jumped all over Gideon's back. Why in the world would you leave us out? We are Ephraimites. We are the most prominent. And you would dare go to battle without checking with us first? Nehemiah faced a similar struggle with his enemies, who saw him rebuilding the wall, and they weren't part of the plan, and so they said, "Oh, Nehemiah, the only reason you want to build the wall is so that you can be the king." Perhaps they said to Gideon, "The only reason you took 300 was so that you could get all of the glory, not have to share the loot with many people, so your name would be known as the Baal contender." Now, the way that Gideon handles his critics here is incredible to me, because if I try to slip into his sandals, I would have responded in exact opposition to what he did. But I want to give you three ways that he handles his critics. Number one, he handles them with tact, T-A-C-T. Tact is the ability to take into account the feelings of another person and respond in relation to how they feel. I was reading a book by Swindoll recently, and he retold an old story that is rather humorous about the husband who lacked tact. This husband's wife was going on a European tour, and the day that she left, flying to New York first, their cat died. So she called him from New York the next day when she had arrived, and she said, "Honey, how's everything going?" And he just bluntly came out and said, "The cat's dead." And she was shocked and chided him through tears. "You know, you should have been more tactful." And he said, "Well, what should I have said?" Husbands say that. "What should I have done?" And she said, "Well, you could have told me in degrees, little by little. Like when I arrived in New York, you could have said, 'Honey, the cat's on the roof.' And then when I arrived the next day into Paris, you could have said, 'Honey, the cat fell off the roof.' And then the following day from Rome, you could have told me, 'Sweetheart, the cat's at the veterinary hospital and it doesn't look too good.' And then finally, a few days later, you could tell me, 'I'm sorry, but the cat died.'" And he said, "You are so right, and I apologize for my tactlessness." And they kind of made things right there. And then they were talking. And a little later in the conversation, she says, "Oh, by the way, how's my mother doing?" And he said, after a long pause, "Well, she's on the roof." Classic illustration of what tact is not. Tact is the ability to understand how someone might feel and respond in that way. Somebody once wrote it this way: tact is making someone feel at home when you really wish they were. Whether right or wrong, in fact, Gideon here in this passage has every right to nail Ephraim's hide to the wall. You come to me complaining about the fact that you didn't get an invitation to fight? God chose me. He called me. He empowered our little force. We didn't plan it that way. We wanted 32,000 men. But instead, look at what he says to them. It's incredible. Chapter 8, verse 2. But he said, "What have I done now in comparison with you?" And I'm saying, come on, Gideon. These windbags didn't do a thing. You put your neck on the line with 300 men, and you're saying, what have I done now in comparison to you? No telling how many soldiers they had in capturing Raven and the wolf. Is Gideon just flattering here? He's literally seeing it from their perspective, which is very tactful. And from their perspective, Gideon hadn't done anything. He had never raised a sword. He had never involved himself in hand-to-hand combat. All he had done was shouted and waved a torch from their perspective. They were the ones that got involved in hand-to-hand combat and captured the raven and the wolf. So Gideon, seeing it from their point of view, responds very tactfully. And along that same line, he also responds, secondly, very humbly. That is, he responds with humility. He's big enough to highlight their achievement. Look at verse 3. God has given the leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, into your hands. And what was I able to do in comparison with you? The truth is, Gideon had not fought hand to hand. And he very humbly steps down, which is very difficult to do, especially when you've just done what Gideon did. And look at them and, in a sense, consider them greater than yourself, which is, by the way, a New Testament command given to you and me. Gideon understands that at this point, when disharmony could split the tribes into a bitter dispute, he recognizes the fact that collective harmony is much more important than collecting honor. The only correction that he makes is found in this third item, I'll tell you. He handles them with focus. He implicitly states in the text that God is in control. In fact, the only correction that Gideon makes to these men is the fact that they seem to be leaving God out. He isn't troubled with the fact that he isn't getting the credit. He seems to be troubled with the fact that God isn't getting any credit. Because look at verse 1 again. You remember they said, why didn't you call us when you went to fight against Midian? And Gideon is saying, you're missing it. And in verse 3, he sort of subtly implies, as he says, God has given the leaders of Midian into your hands. He's sort of reminding them, listen, you didn't get the raven. You didn't get the wolf. And I didn't do what I did. I submitted to God, but God through me, God through you, accomplished what he did. You study the lives of men and women in the Old Testament who are godly, and you will discover the reoccurring common ingredient that they are all too anxious to give God the credit for whatever has happened. Now, for those who criticize, we find here an illustration. Let's pull apart what their complaint is really revealing about themselves. Number one, that they are more interested in their own involvement than in God's intentions. The Ephraimites were political Christians, if you would. They were the right people to be seen with, and they would make sure that they were always involved in the right things. And by the way, routing the Midianites would have looked wonderful on their tribal resume. And they're a little upset that they don't have that feather in their cap. It isn't what God is interested in. It's what I can do to develop my own reputation. Secondly, they were more concerned about receiving glory, obviously, than in giving glory. At this point, I would expect them to come across with the two defeated kings and slap Gideon on the back and say, isn't God wonderful? Let's share stories of what God has recently done. They are more interested in receiving it than in giving it. In fact, they are acting like very spoiled little children who haven't gotten the present that they wanted to get. I was in the grocery store, which is one of the least favorite places to be on God's green earth. There's a gal with a little kid in a cart, and the kid is throwing a fit. You've been to those checkout lanes, you guys. You know, they're a study all in themselves. You get into that lane, and to your left, eye level, are all these tabloids, you know, with the headlines. And I usually get a chuckle. I'm in there reading them myself, and I'm standing there at the lane. I was there the other day, and it's, you know, the latest Elvis sightings. And a woman abducted by alien spaceship. All that. Not that I don't believe this, by the way, if you buy these things. There's a lot behind them, I'm sure. But at any rate, to the right, you know what's on the right side? Candy. Row after row of candy. And you know the bottom shelf is all the way down to the ground. No adult can comfortably reach down that low, but a kid can. And the top shelf is no higher than a two-year-old's ability from their cart seat to reach up and grab. And that's what this kid was after. And I was just kind of standing there between the Elvis sightings and this mom, just, you know, glad I was in and out of there, bless her heart. He was pitching a fit. You know what's really bad? Is when an adult pitches a fit because they don't get their way. It may be a power play. It may be manipulation. It may be criticism. What they are in effect saying is, I'd like to be a little more preeminent here. You left me out. That's what's happening here. Now, if you think I'm reading them wrong, turn over to chapter 12, verse 1, because the same thing happens again, and it literally is mind-blowing. Chapter 12, verse 1, then the men of Ephraim were summoned, and they crossed to Zaphon and said to Jephthah, why did you cross over to fight against the sons of Ammon without calling us to go with you? We will burn your house down on you. Oh, my goodness. There they are. You left us out. We're going to burn your house down. How immature. They had a problem. Ephraimites, you'd better include them or you're going to feel the wrath. Problem number two is very similar, but just a tad different. It's the problem of disunity. And notice how Gideon handles it. Let's read on in chapter 8. Let's go to verse 4. Then Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came to the Jordan and crossed over. Note these words, weary yet pursuing. If you've ever needed a theme verse for following God as a housewife, as a businessman or a woman, wherever you're serving the Lord, you're worn out. Here it is, weary yet pursuing. Next verse, verse 5. And he said to the men of Succoth, please give loaves of bread to the people who are following me, for they are weary, and I am pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian. And the leaders of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hands that we should give bread to your army? Verse 7. And Gideon said, all right, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will thrash your bodies with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. That is, you will be disciplined. And he went up from there to Penuel and spoke similarly to them. And the men of Penuel answered him just as the men of Succoth had answered. So he spoke also to the men of Penuel, saying, when I return safely, I will tear down this tower. That's a clue. What's happening here? Succoth and Penuel are western tribes located on the other side of the Jordan River. What they are facing is fear. They probably also enjoy a brisk trade with the Midianites as they come through their region into their annual pillaging of the Canaanite lands. But they also face this. If Gideon loses and the Midianites discover that these western tribes have helped Gideon, who do you think is going to be the first that they attack with revenge in their minds? These two tribes. What these two tribes are basically struggling with is their choice of enemies. They've chosen wrongly. Because they have basically said, we would rather have God as our enemy. We would rather have the people of Israel at odds with us than the enemies of God. Fear makes us do strange things. The two tribes here are struggling then with Ephraim, with its pride or with its status, and these two tribes with their security, with their fear. How does Gideon handle their fear and the disunity it caused? I want to give you a couple of ways. Number one, Gideon did not allow it to distract. Look at verse 10, chapter 8. Now, Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor, and their armies with them, about 15,000 men, all who were left of the entire army of the sons of the east, for the fallen were 120,000 swordsmen. And Gideon went up by the way of those who lived in tents on the east of Nobah and Jokbehah and attacked the camp when the camp was unsuspecting. In other words, the Midianites thought, no, Gideon can't come this far. They've had camels to their aid. He can't reach us here. We're safe. And it's at that point that Gideon arrives and attacks. He is not then distracted by those who in fear want to fight in his walk of faith. He doesn't allow their insecurity in God's promises and in God's power to paralyze his own walk. And ladies and gentlemen, you will at times perhaps be referred to as a person who's doing something that cannot be done. Someone who should be encouraging you might say, you can't do that. You lack knowledge or experience or whatever. Basically, what we find here are these tribes taunting Gideon. that goes beyond their fear. It actually states that they were saying, Gideon, there's no way in the world you'll ever do it. But he never allowed it to distract them. Secondly, Gideon doesn't allow it to develop within the nation. Look at verse 15. Then he returned to the men of Succoth and said, Behold, or look here, Zelba and Zalmunna. You remember you taunted me saying, Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand and we should give bread to your men who are weary? You taunted me. You said, I can't do it. Then he took the elders of the city and he took thorns of the wilderness and briars and he disciplined the men of Succoth with them. And he tore down the tower of Penuel. That's interesting because the tower is the position of security. It's their safety. It's where they run when the enemy attacks. He says, you guys have been depending on this tower way too long. We're going to take it away. You depend on God. So Gideon here returns then as God's judge to discipline. He takes the lives of the elders because they had become as the Midianites. They refused to follow God. And God, in effect, through Gideon says, disunity cannot be tolerated. And you know something? It cannot be tolerated as well in the church. I don't want to torture the text here in making applications that don't fit. And although I see vast differences of Israel and the church, there are some overarching truths. Let me give you a couple of them. Number one, God never intended his people to function disunified. And when I talk of disunity, I'm not talking about, you know, some method or some practice. I'm talking about the essentials, the doctrines that we as this church hold dear. Inerrancy is not up for grabs. The literal interpretation of Scripture is not being voted on. If we ever become disunified on the virgin birth of Jesus Christ, or a literal resurrection of Christ from the grave, we are in effect saying, God, you might as well just write right over the door, Ichabod. Because we can't function with that. In fact, Romans chapter 16, verse 70, let me quote to you these words. Now I urge you, brethren, keep your eye on those who cause dissensions and hindrances. How? Contrary to the teaching which you have learned, and turn away from them. That literally means to avoid them, to step around them. A disunified church is a disabled church. Our unity comes from our allegiances to this book and to our Lord the Shepherd who wrote it. Now, Satan doesn't care what issue it is, but he just cares that we're divided. Warning number two goes a little bit further than that one. Let me give it to you. God never allows his people to minister effectively divided. Revelation chapter 2 tells the story of a church that is divided in its objective. They have lost their love, their first love, their first priority to honor and glorify God and to reach their world. They had forgotten that, and although they were seemingly existing, they had ceased to minister effectively. And Jesus Christ's words are powerful there as he says to this church, repent or else I will come and take the lampstand away. What is he saying? You can go on functioning, but I'm going to take away your potential for effectiveness. I'm going to take away your testimony. I'm going to take away your light, your saltiness. Let me make two further applications here so we don't misunderstand. Number one, it's possible for a church to exist without experiencing effectiveness. Secondly, it is possible for a church to function physically without experiencing fulfillment spiritually. That's possible. But a unified church is the most powerful force on planet Earth. And you and I were left here in this century, at this moment, in this city, to be his tool in reaching his world. I love Acts chapter 17, verse 6, where the city officials in Thessalonica said of the church leaders and the church testimony, they said, these are they who have turned the world upside down. If there is ever a call for unity, and an awareness of fear, of pride, status, security, as the enemies that they are, it is Judges chapter 8. An issue of the National Geographic had within its issue a photograph of the fossilized remains of two saber-toothed cats who have long been extinct. It's interesting because evidently these cats had been involved in a war between themselves. And let me just quote for you what the article said. One of the cats had bitten deep into the leg bone of the other, a thrust that trapped both in a common fate. The cause of the death of the two cats was clear. In other words, they were unable to disentangle from their conflict, and both died. Let me read you the words of the Apostle Paul. If you bite and devour one another, take heed lest you destroy one another. Are we seeking God's glory or our glory? Are we following God's purposes or our purposes? His direction or our designs? You know how you can answer that? By answering that, first of all, individually. Whose agenda are you following? If we are a unified church, it is only because we each individually are stepping down and recognizing the value and the merits and the accomplishments of someone else. We are handling criticism with tact and with focus. And we are at odds with anything that will disunify us. And we, like Gideon, will not allow it to exist if we seek his plan, his purpose, his glory, his honor, his cause.
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. This message is copyrighted and may be shared, but not sold or altered. For information or to access more resources, visit wisdomonline.org.